Hello and welcome to episode 4 of Engaging Internal Comms, the show for employee engagers and internal communicators who like to keep up to date with new ideas and innovations in our profession. Hello, my name's Craig Smith from The Big Picture People. I hope you're enjoying this first season of Engaging Internal Comms. If you've not heard the first three episodes, you can catch up on those at engagingic.com or via your favourite podcast platform. Next week, we have a really interesting interview coming up with Amy Holmes from Marshalls, and we're going to be looking at how you can use traditional communications channels more successfully. If you've not already found it as well, we have a private Facebook group and a Facebook page. The Facebook page can be found at facebook.com/engagingic. And the link to the Facebook group, which is a private members only group, can be found on the main page of our podcast site, which is engagingic.com. Anyway, on to today's interview. In this fourth episode of Engaging Internal Comms, we're going to be looking at an area that I think we'll end up coming back to quite a lot during other future episodes because it's so important, and it's the topic of purpose. Our interviewee today has got an amazing story to tell about a big shift in their own career, which all resulted from a reevaluation of their personal purpose and how that led to a very different career path to the one that they were originally heading down. But I think it raises some really interesting questions for our own careers, but also for that of our employees and how we can connect them to their own personal purpose in life and how we can make sure that the purpose of our organization is aligned with that and motivating for them. So I think you'll find this a really interesting interview. There's some amazing stories, and I'll hope to get some feedback from you. If you could leave some feedback after you've listened to the show on our website, engagingic.com, that would be really useful, and as would it with all of these episodes that we're putting out, to find out if there's any areas that you'd like us to cover in the future and any other topics that you're interested in. So I hope you enjoy this interview. Okay, so today's interview is with Professor Graham Ward. So Graham has been at INSEAD since 2000, and we're going to get a little bit more information about what INSEAD is in a moment. But he is the adjunct professor of organizational behavior at INSEAD, at the business school there, and he's also had his own consulting business since 2004. Really interestingly, Graham used to be a trader at Goldman Sachs for 17 years. I'm going to talk a little bit about that transition from that into his current life. And Graham also has a PhD from Amsterdam University. So good morning, Graham. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing fine. Thank you. And Craig, thanks for having me.
No, it's an absolute pleasure. And yes, you're in London at the moment, and we just talked a little bit about the weather down there. So it's sort of quite nice down there at the moment, I understand.
It's a bit tropical, which is concerning, I think. We should all be worried about that.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So, I said a little, tell us a little bit more about INSEAD. I think a few of our listeners have probably heard of it, but probably don't fully understand what INSEAD is all about. Could you just give us a little bit of an elevator pitch for INSEAD, please?
Sure, absolutely. So INSEAD is one of the sort of classical business schools, founded about 70 years ago, in the 1950s. And it's known as the business school for the world. And, you know, that's the sort of, if you like, the subtext when you look at INSEAD. And the great thing about it is that, and the way that it differentiates itself from other business schools essentially, is that when you walk into the cafeteria there, or if you go to any of the lectures there, it's like walking into the United Nations. It's incredible. And very often, you know, if you go to some of these American universities, it tends to be very sort of Anglo-Saxon, American-centric. But INSEAD's really amazing, and you have participants literally from Africa, Asia, Middle East, you name it. And you get this really differentiated learning experience because, you know, if you want to learn from your peers, who better to learn from than people at the far-flung corners of the planet? You can really pick up some interesting stuff. So I love working there. It's a great place to be to do executive education or an MBA.
Fantastic. And INSEAD, geographically, where is the HQ, or where is the main teaching facilities for INSEAD? Or is it literally dotted around all over?
It's not, in fact. I mean, they have a camp. The main campus was outside of Paris, about 100 kilometers outside of Paris, in Fontainebleau, in the edge of the woods where Louis the 14th used to hunt. And they set up a Singapore campus back when Asia was booming about 20 years ago, and then a campus in Abu Dhabi, and then just set up a hub in San Francisco in one of these beautiful dockside warehouses. So, yeah, we're opening up and just outside the valley too.
We met via LinkedIn, and you said some really insightful posts around the whole situation, because we're recording this in the middle of the pandemic, and you touched upon some really interesting things about purpose and connection with purpose that really resonated and I thought would be really interesting to the people who listen to this show, because one of the perennial challenges of internal communicators, employee engagers, is how do we connect our people to the organizational purpose. And I mean, just before we dive into that, I'd mentioned it at the beginning, the introduction, this amazing transition that you made after 17 years as a trader for Goldman Sachs into this academia and consultancy. How did that happen? And just tell us a little bit about that story, because I'm sure there's lots of richness in that.
So, yeah, and if I may, I'll give you the backstory, because I think it gives the context. And I think for many people listening, they will recognize elements of their own story in this. I came from a broken home. I came from a background that was quite poor, very working class. Mm-hmm. And at 18 years old, all I wanted to do was be rich. It was just my single focus. I want to be as rich as I can for as long as I can, so that the world can essentially leave me alone. And so I set out to do that. And I went to work in the city, and through a little bit of good fortune and a bit of hard work, I ended up at Goldman Sachs at 24 years old, which is back in 1987. And of course, it was a great place to work. It was, you know, it was the best of the best. They were an incredible investment bank. They'd just come to London. And I worked there for a long while, and it was sort of fulfilling the dream. The problem was that, you know, by the age of 37, 38, and I'd been working in the business for 20 years, the paychecks, even though they were absurdly big by any standards, even back then, and, you know, you end up in the top sort of 1% of the population in terms of your earnings, were not making me happy. And this was a conundrum, because, and it was a contradiction, and it created a lot of internal dissonance. Like, well, you know, if I've fulfilled the dream, if I'm doing what I set out to do, why am I not feeling good about this? And what I noticed, and by then I was running a fairly big business and I had a couple of hundred people working sort of in the end underneath me and my co-heads, what I noticed was that a lot of other people weren't happy either. So I was not alone in that. And I tried to resolve it and figure out how to resolve it. And it was resolved actually by a bit of sort of shock therapy, almost literally, because what happened was I was sent on a leadership course in Connecticut, and I turned up there with eight of my peers, and we sat down in this room with a couple of psychoanalysts for 3 days who sort of walked us through leadership 101 and did a bit of psychodynamic investigation at the same time. And it just dawned on me then and there, I just shouldn't be doing this anymore. And I was 38 years old, and it's a very worrying feeling when you've invested a lot of your life in doing something and you come to this very quick realization, I need to stop. I need to go do something different. So to cut to the chase and really answer your question, Craig, what happened was the story goes that the psychoanalyst phoned my boss over the weekend as I was traveling back from Connecticut and said, listen, if you don't do something with Graham, he's going to leave. And I was called in on Monday morning, and my boss, who was Dutch, said, so I understand you are leaving us. I was like, holy crap, there's 20 years down the toilet. You know, I've been betrayed. And it didn't work out that way, because luckily I was working for a guy who was a little enlightened and a little visionary. And I said, listen, I'm not happy, and I haven't been happy for a while. And it just came up on this course last week. He said, what do you want to do? I said, I want to be a psychologist. And he said, well, you know, they're 10 a penny. Anyone can be a psychologist. He said, why don't you stay here and do something, you know, kind of interesting here? So he made me head of leadership development, which was completely countercultural. Wow. And very strange, because I wasn't an HR guy, and it caused a lot of ripples inside Goldman Sachs. But it's the kind of place that they take risk, and they took risk, and I stayed there for another 3 years and basically ran leadership development.
Wow. Okay. Well, so And how did it feel for that 3 years when you were running the leadership? I mean, was that, did it satisfy any of that? Or did it satisfy any of that dissatisfaction, if that's the right thing to say? Did it feel as though you were sort of going through the motions and you still needed to get away from that whole environment?
Do you know what really happened, Craig, was that I was like a kid in a candy store. They sent me to INSEAD, which is how the INSEAD thing started. I said, I need to study something. And I went and did a master's degree in organizational psychology. And I just realized there was a whole domain of work that was unexplored for me. And I got so excited about it. At the end of the 3 years, it was sort of, you know, the itch was more than scratched in one way. But on the other hand, it was like, okay, what can I really do with this? And I got very excited, took the plunge and just left and said, I'm going to set up my own consulting firm. And
So I guess, you know, I think it's a really useful backstory in that. I think we've probably all felt that at various stages of our career, whether we have actually made that plunge or whether we've decided to sort of persist and weighed up the options. And I think that's an interesting area we'll probably explore when people are at that point. And also, you know, when you're maybe have a responsibility for keeping people engaged, and you may have a significant number of people who are in that position where the job or the position is too good to give up, and yet people are fundamentally unhappy. But I guess just going back to your story, is how has that kind of led to what you're, I mean, I guess that has had an impact on what you're interested in now and what your kind of current focus is, because this whole idea of what is our purpose individually and collectively, and how do we re-examine that purpose? So just give me that sort of join the dots there for me from that personal experience into what you're doing now and what your interest is professionally and academically now.
Yeah. Well, I guess, you know, there's a few things. I mean, first of all, seeing a bunch of people that were earning a lot of money and not very happy made me realize there's more to life, not only for me, but for a lot of other people. What also became clear to me was that around midlife, is when these existential questions start to come up. And there's very good psychological reasons for that, as I since discovered. Namely, you know, the time starts to speed up and your kids are getting older. You know, your body starts to change and people just essentially start to question, okay, I've got a certain amount of time left. What can I do with that time? So that became very compelling for me. How can I help people to really discover what they're really meant to do? What are they here for? And so as a result of that, my first sort of leap into this was to train as a coach and to sit and talk with people. And why was that? Well, I guess the reason going backwards into my sort of business career was that people would very often just come and talk with me, say, can I be a voice in your ear, or, you know, can I lean on you for a few moments? And we'd sit and talk. And my management role became much more that than the deal making. And I realized, obviously, there's a sweet spot for me here. So my coaching business was the first sort of embarkation point. And it kind of grew from there. But I spent a lot of time in those first 3 or 4 years just sitting with individuals, initially coaching them. And then it morphed into something quite different.
Okay. So what, just in a nutshell then, just you explained there a little bit about, and I can totally relate to that sort of time speeding up thing that you mentioned there about life at a certain point that you get to where it does seem to be sort of not slipping through your fingers, because I love what I do and I'm blessed in that respect, but the kind of sense of, you know, accelerating an unrelenting pace. So in terms of your particular take on purpose and that side of it, is it really focusing on people who are at that sort of midlife career stage and helping them, or is it broader than that? How what's your sort of particular angle that you focus on, and how you attract people to you to support and help them?
Well, I'm interested in developmental theory, and I love the works of people like Piaget and Bob Keegan, and I spend a lot of time talking about that and thinking about that when I'm lecturing. And in the end, people like I do feel often very dissonant, and they realize there's only a certain amount of days. What am I going to do with those days? And I like this Japanese model, which is a very simple model, which is known as Ikigai. And I talked about that in one of my little 2-minute lectures that I gave on LinkedIn, which is, you know, you need to get paid. You've got to keep the lights on. Fine. You want to spend your life doing stuff that you're really interested in or that you like, because otherwise, what's the point? But then there's a couple of things that people tend to sort of ignore. What are you good at? And then most importantly, what does the world need? And, you know, people are very often doing things that they're not particularly good at. That's a strange thing to say, but very often they're not great. I was not the world's greatest trader. I was okay as a trader. It kept the lights on, you know, but actually what I was really good at was working with people. And it was a very, you know, at places like professional service firms, people that work with people are not highly valued. That's not what you're supposed to do. You're supposed to make money, you know, or if you're a law firm, you're working for a law firm, you're supposed to bill the clients. And actually, if your sweet spot is, I'm really good with people, maybe you should use that. And so my real angle is helping people through transition. How do you transcend between one place and another? Because in that space between one place and another, there's often a lot of anxiety and a lot of fear and a lot of courage is required to face up to doing something that's often quite different to the path that you've beaten to date.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's an older model now, and the William Bridges transition model of, you know, the kind of endings in between and new beginnings. And it's very simplistic in a certain extent, but it's very useful in terms of breaking it down into that sort of disconnecting from my past, being kind of a bit amorphous and kind of having to find my own way and then sort of trying to reconstitute myself in a new, better normal, I think is in, and I think that works on an organizational level as well as an individual level as well for groups of people. Just thinking then, relating this to sort of some of the people who'll be listening to this recording, which is people who are working internally, where they've probably got, they may have groups of people who are, you know, at these different stages of life. And again, it's very difficult, I think, when you're in that sort of position to, you know, one size fits all, because people are very obviously by their nature have got different aspirations, different life goals, different life situations. Just in terms of how someone who's maybe working on a broader organizational agenda can maybe start to think about, you know, some of these questions that their people might have, that they may be thinking about, where am I at, am I best fitted to this? They may be having some of these sort of life stage questions. What are some of the things that someone who's managing a lot of people in a big organization can start to do to start to help people to work out whether the purpose that they've got is the right, you know, it's the best fit for what the organization needs, but also to ask some of these more fundamental questions about am I best suited to what I'm actually doing at the moment? Because I agree with you. I think a lot of people, it's not exactly the Peter principle, but a lot of people find themselves drifting into roles where they've just found themselves there and they're not really sure how they got there. And is this really what I wanted to spend my life doing? And am I very good at it? It's a fundamental question, I guess. So how can organizations start to, you know, embed some of those ideas that you've sort of been just been talking about there?
Yeah. Well, I mean, if it was someone listening to this, you know, I would want them to ask themselves the question, you know, a few very important questions, and not in a trite way, but, you know, you need to ask yourself, one, am I happy? And if you're not, then acknowledge that. If there is a nagging feeling, acknowledge that feeling. If you're not learning anything, you know, am I learning anything here? If you're not learning anything for too long, you should actually move and challenge yourself a little bit. We're incredibly adaptable species. And so, you know, learn something new. Try to find ways to challenge yourself. Don't play it too safe. You know, play to win rather than playing not to lose. I think it's important to continue to take risk through the life cycle. It doesn't have to be, you know, you don't have to put your family and house in jeopardy, but take some risk. But when I think it comes to managing other people, and no manager would like the answer that I'm about to give, it really requires you to invest time in each person individually. You will never find this out because they'll come and tell you. If they come and tell you, it's often too late. You actually need to sit with people and you need to ask them wide open questions like, how are you doing? And how are you doing when you mean, how are you actually doing? Not just like as in, how's life? So, you know, and I think you need to do that with each person on your team from time to time and talk about what's going on with them. What that requires is us to be really, really good listeners. And people overestimate and over-index how good they are at listening. We're not very good listeners. Now, you're a great listener, Craig. You've been quiet now for about 3 minutes while I've been giving you this long answer. But we need to learn to listen. It's a skill, and managers need to learn that. Otherwise, they won't find out what's going on with their people.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, again, it collectively, I think organizations need to get better at that as well. Because I think there's a lot of, I mean, particularly in internal communications, I think there's some really good work. There's a lot of what I call broadcasting, though. There's a lot of one way, you know, which is, you know, by nature of some of the roles, and particularly, you know, as I said, well, a particular situation at the minute with the pandemic, is there is a lot of information that needs to be divulged and shared. But there is also, I think organizations, particularly at the moment, have realized the importance of listening as well. And I guess just sort of linking this then into a kind of, again, just into a more organizational level. I know there's some research just been done recently, reasonable, you know, not a massive statistical validity, I guess, but some research done around about that 73% of organizations are going to be needing to re-engage people around purpose and strategy. And I think one of the things we talked about when we spoke before the interview was this idea that the things that's going to probably come out of this pandemic is that organizations and individuals within those organizations are probably going to be reevaluating what's important to them. I mean, what's your take on that in terms of what is the impact? I mean, and again, I'm conscious of not falling into the danger of crystal balls and trying to predict the future. But I mean, what do you think the impact is going to be of the pandemic in terms of the way that organizations and individuals within those organizations think about purpose and what they want to deliver collectively and individually?
Well, I think it's caused everybody on the planet. It's the first time that everyone on the planet is in the same boat at the same time. It's caused everyone to reflect a little bit on who they are, what they want, and what they want to be. And that will be true for systems as well as it will for individuals. So I think the organizations that have mission statements that have not been properly thought through, or purpose statements that have not been thought through, are going to need to go back to the drawing board and rip those up and be really honest and validate those with their people. Because otherwise, it's going to the people around are going to smell a rat. I think what the people I've been talking to have been asking themselves the question, what does my organization really stand for? And how does it really genuinely contribute to society? And there's this new notion of B to S, which is business to society. And I think it's going to become more important, more prevalent. And in order to address that, you're going to have to bring in all of the stakeholders, not just outside of the firm, but certainly inside the firm. We're talking about the millennial generation, because the millennial generation is eminently transferable. It is genuinely less loyal. And that's your talent pipeline. And if you cannot address the way that you go about your business with that crowd of people, you will lose your best talent. So I think it's mission critical, actually, for organizations to consider this and to do so fast. I've been talking to a number of people in the last week under the age of 30. Now, this is not my normal coaching constituency, but for me to stay in touch with that particular group is important, because they're the coming leaders, and leadership is one of the things that I spend a lot of time talking about. And I can tell you that if you set yourself up as an organization as having so-called green credentials, and you're not living by those green credentials, the tolerance for that will diminish really, really quickly. So I think boards and executive committees are going to have to put that on their agenda and think about it actively.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think it's going to be really interesting to see how we do come out. I think there's everybody's talking about the new normal, and I hope it is. And I really hope it is a tipping point, because there's this inherent complacency that we, you know, we have that our ability to forget, you know, very profound moments in life and revert back to the old behaviors very quickly without really learning something. So I really do hope that organizations do take the opportunity to learn. And as a society, we learn from that. And I think that's really important. And I totally agree with you. I think in terms of, I think the whole millennials and expectations that they had to be working somewhere where there was a purpose behind what the organization was doing has definitely been brought more sharply into focus. And I don't think it's just millennials as well. I mean, I agree with you. It's probably they're more purpose-driven and purpose-orientated But I think a lot of people are asking those questions across, you know, across all different age groups as to, and I think it's been broadly sharply into focus as well by the fact that people have realized they can, you know, people who thought they would never, ever be able to work from home have been able to transition into that. I'm not saying it's been painless, but I think there are a lot of people who've been able to reflect on what they've been able to do in this period that, and realize that actually they probably can do a lot more than they ever gave themselves credit for. And maybe that's been liberating for them.
I think that's right. And, you know, but one of the things that's around a lot at the moment, of course, is anxiety. People are fearful. They're anxious about losing their job, their livelihood. Unemployment is going up. I noticed a few weeks ago that trust in government had gone, in governments around the world had gone through the roof during this crisis, but it's now starting to diminish really, really quickly. And what's interesting is that trust in organizations is starting to come back. Now, that will also only have a very short half-life if the organizations don't live up to their promise and don't break the social contracts, which, as you said, and you've used this expression, new normal, the world will have changed. We are creatures of habit. We would like to go back and life would just carry on just as it did before. It's highly unlikely. There has been a rupture. This is a real fault line. And this fault line won't be, you know, when we revisit it, it's going to look quite different after the earthquake.
Yeah, I agree. So just for bringing things to a conclusion. So relating it back to our listeners. Again, a lot of them are going to be faced with this challenge of how do we bring this purpose into life? How do we make sure that our values are relevant to what people want going forward? And again, as a danger, I guess that's just seen as something we need to formulate in the boardroom and then just sort of communicate out. And what any practical advice, tips, guidance for someone who's kind of thinking, okay, this is going to be a key part of my agenda when I get back, or when we get back to some sense of normality, whatever that is, what can they start thinking about now in terms of making sure that they're really tuning into that purpose that their people or the changed purpose perhaps for them and for the, you know, I really like the idea of B2S, the sort of business to society thing. What can they start doing now, do you think?
Well, ask yourself the question, as Pete Drucker did, why do we exist? And, you know, so it's getting to that why. And so that's the first thing. And then when you've figured out the answer to that question, I think the way to really get at this, which is, again, it takes a bit of work, is to workshop it. I think you need to be in the organization and have people sit and talk about the culture, which is the lens through which all of this stuff emerges. And so, okay, so what kind of culture do we have and what do we want? How do we want to work and be together in this particular tribe of people that's called this company? And once you've figured that out, this is what we stand for. This is what we will not stand for. These are our red lines. What do we want to, and this is going to sound like a strange expression, Craig, but it's like, what do we want our sons and daughters to be? And what I mean is, you know, our next generation of people. Then and only then you've got a horizon through which to work, towards which to work. And I think you get at that through the cultural lens. And so I think to workshop that and to ask people the question actually has been proven to improve engagement. You know, people get engaged when you start, but only, of course, if you do something about it. If you ask the question, you don't address it, trust goes down. So you've got to be prepared to do something with the result.
Yeah, you know, I agree. I think that my worst fear is that that organizations, just because of the pressure to, you know, get revenue back to where it was and return things to normal as quickly as possible, they kind of overlook the fact that actually this is a tremendous learning opportunity for us as an organization, and our people have probably learned more about themselves than they'll ever get an opportunity to again. And unless we take time to debrief that and then also understand how that impacts on where we need to point the organization going forward, so they're with us, I think it would be a real shame. And I do worry that in some respects, this kind of hybrid model that seems like it's going to exist, where some people are working at home and some are in the office and they're kind of rotating around, and it might lead to a sense of, you know, normality returning before we've had really had a chance to try and make sense of it all. But that all remains to be seen anyway. So,
Well, I think people have been traumatized a little bit by this, and we shouldn't underestimate the emotional roller coaster that people have gone through. And so when you talk about this debrief, You need to bring people back and talk about where they've been before you talk about where they want to be. And only then, with that sort of group experience, people can talk about their own journey. They may have lost people in their family. They may have come close to death themselves. Who knows? But certainly many people will have felt incredibly lonely through this 2 to 3 month period. I think it's important to re-engage them through the use of their emotional journey and then say, okay, so great, this is where we are. Now what do we want to be going forward? I think it'd be very valuable and powerful and certainly very engaging.
Definitely. No, I totally agree. That's been amazing, Graham. Thank you very much. So, I mean, I normally try and finish off an interview with trying to find out something else that we didn't know about you. We already know you were a trader at Goldman Sachs. We know you're a rampant Arsenal fan who his first game was against Newcastle United. What any other sort of little gems of secret knowledge about that we can find out about you that we haven't already found out about you, Graham?
Oh, something about me. Well, I mean, the thing that raises most people's eyebrows. I used to live in Sweden. I only moved back to the UK about 3 months ago. But the big birthday in Sweden is your 50th birthday. And people go crazy on their 50th birthdays. And I was 57 years ago. My wife said to me, "You're going to throw a huge party, right?" I said, "No, because I'm a little bit of an introvert. I love teaching, but I'm an introvert." She said, "What do you want to do?" I said, "I want to go to North Korea." And I think the teacup sort of dropped on the floor. And she said, "You're serious, right?" And I said, "Sure." So we landed in North Korea, literally on my 50th birthday. And as we go through the customs hall, which is essentially an aircraft hangar, they give you a sort of vetting, as you can imagine, going into North Korea. And as I walked through, this young lady stepped forward and in perfect English presented me with a bouquet of flowers and said, "Welcome to the Democratic Republic of North Korea, Dr. Ward. We understand it's your 50th birthday," which is on the one hand incredibly touching and on the other hand rather scary and Orwellian. Yeah.
Fantastic. Oh, that's amazing. I used to run a lot of marathons, and a friend of mine who was equally sort of obsessed was for years trying to get me to go and do the Pyongyang marathon with him, but he never managed to talk me into it. But I do admit it's probably a little bit more scary now, but it would be an interesting place to go and visit if you could be sure that you wouldn't fall foul of the law by doing something quite innocuous.
But yes. Yeah, it was a fascinating experience as a student of leadership, which is why I wanted to go there. It was very, very rewarding, but of course tragic. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Anyway, look, Graham, how can, if people want to engage with you and find out more about your work, I mean, your LinkedIn profile has got some amazing content. You've done some great videos on there. Any other, as obviously I can find you on LinkedIn, and I'll put a link to your LinkedIn profile in the show notes. I know you've got a couple of other websites. I don't know whether you want to talk about those at all or any other ways that people can engage with you.
You can find me through the INSEAD website. I teach a number of programs at INSEAD. I think I currently run 7 executive programs for companies at INSEAD. You can find me on LinkedIn. I just love talking to people, and people connect with me, and you know, they want to have a chat about something. If I can find the time, I like to do that, because you know, very often it leads into an interesting conversation. Sometimes we end up doing some work together. But you know, if I can be in any way helpful to people as they move forward, either individually or in their organizations, I'm always happy to have that conversation, because I don't want people to go through life in some kind of pain. Let's try and be happy here and be fulfilled, and that's kind of become my mission. That's what I love to do, and so I'm happy to talk with anybody anytime. And
absolutely. Fantastic. And Twitter, I know I found your Twitter sort of Arsenal secret on there. You use Twitter, or is that more of a personal thing?
It's more of a personal thing, and actually I've given it up, because I found that through the whole Brexit process, and then when Donald Trump was elected, it became the sort of, unfortunately, it became for me the bargain basement of how people should think about the world. Okay. I didn't find it very generous, so I'm still there, and I look at it a lot, but I don't really contribute too much.
No, I know. It can be a frustrating place to dwell. I agree with you, Anyway, look, Graham, that has been absolutely fantastic. Thank you very much for your time. A really enlightening conversation. Really appreciate it. And I look forward to speaking to you again at some point in the near future.
Graham, it was an absolute pleasure. Thanks for inviting me on.
Thank you. So thank you very much for listening to Engaging Internal Comms. We hope you found this episode useful and interesting. We'd love to get your thoughts about the show and any questions you have or ideas for topics that you'd like to maybe cover in future episodes. You can email us at info@thebigpicturepeople.co.uk, or you can get in touch with us via the contact form at engagingic.com. You can also sign up for our mailing list there, and we'll send you relevant news about the show, future episodes, and we'll also let you know about anything interesting we found out about internal communications and employee engagement. If you like the show and you haven't already done so, please subscribe to it via your podcast service. And you can also subscribe via the links on our podcast page, which again is engagingic.com. If you like the show, we'd be really grateful if you could leave us a review. And if you know anyone else who might be interested in the show or might benefit from it, please let them know. Please share it with them and share them with them the links to the show and engagingic.com. Thank you very much.